basketball, a game of giants. And there's number 99, George Mikan, one of the greatest.
Perhaps the most complete player the game has ever seen. The Lakers captain, Elgin Baylor.
2 seconds, 1 second. West throws it up.
Jerry West made it from the other side of the mid-point stripe.
Ford sends it to Kareem. Sky hook up and good. Lakers win.
Magic down the middle, just what I thought. A hook shot at 12. Good!
Shaquille fade away.
Giants for the win. James puts up the three. Oh, it's good!
Doncic on the drive. Step back. Puts it up. Puts it in! With 5 tenths of a second remaining!
What's up, Laker fans? You're listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. I'm Pete, joined by Darius. Indeed, we got some big news today as LeBron James makes his choice, going to the Philadelphia 76ers. Not who I expected. D, what's your reaction?
Not what I expected either. I don't follow the dumb betting market stuff that seems to just exist solely for like random people to make money. Like I don't understand that stuff, honestly. And so I know that Miami was quote unquote in the lead. What I did trust was the reporting that LeBron was looking to head east, which made sense to me. But I was looking way more at like Miami and Cleveland, where I thought his fit within the context of those rosters and what I think those teams needed, which was in Miami's case, a certain amount of playmaking outside of Giannis and just know-how on that roster. And then for the Cavs, a certain amount of backbone and experience that it feels like they lacked. And maybe that's why he didn't go to either of those teams, right? And it makes more sense for him to sort of join an Avengers type of group where he can slide in with his natural talent, slot into a power forward position that was previously occupied by Dean Wade, who they had gotten in free agency. And now LeBron's able to sort of slot him down a spot and intermingle within a top-level roster in terms of the starting five, at least, like with a lot of name guys, and do his LeBron thing. I'm interested to see what that looks like in year 24 with a bunch of other high-usage players and how it all comes together. It's one of those Marlo Stanfield good problems for Nick Nurse over there with having so many mouths to feed. But I just didn't expect it to be Philly. Very passionate fan base, great sports town, but very far away from Los Angeles and all of the familiarity that would have come with Cleveland and Miami. It's quite the thing for him. Where's your head at around it all?
Yeah, certainly a surprise. And I do think that that probably was part of the appeal, is not going back to sort of rehash an old experience, but trying something new. They were allegedly the team that came in second place to the Lakers in 2018, and he was somewhat close to signing with them. I think he really values top-end talent, like the top guys on the roster, and that the back part of the roster, I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but it's more interchangeable, right? That it's more important that your fifth best player is VJ Edgecombe, who's a really good player, and then you got Embiid and Jaylen Brown and Maxey, of course. As you said, they have the vacancy at the power forward spot. You can certainly see the fit, but I had been thinking that Miami was the best fit, in part because I thought they had the best two-way talent. If you get LeBron at $4 million, that there's no way to turn that into, well, I don't know. Like, that is great for your franchise. However, as you know, I'm very skeptical of teams that don't pay anybody to play defense as the main thing that they do. That's not to say LeBron or Embiid or Brown cannot play defense in spurts, right? But that is not the reason why they're on your team or in the league. And that's the one of the first things that my mind goes to with them, is their defense. They're going to need a player or two, or just collectively, to be like, all of us are going to commit to playing defense more often. All of us are going to commit to understanding we're going to get fewer touches. I saw a tweet from Dean Oliver, the analytics guy, that the usage rates of their projected starting five add up to 142%. So someone, or perhaps everybody, is going to have to cut back a little bit in that respect. And then in terms of three-point shooting, you have Maxey at 36.7%, is the best three-point shooter of the bunch. LeBron shot 31.7 from three, the worst shooter in the bunch. So all of them between 31 and 37% from three. One or two of them, LeBron especially, are going to have a bounce back year from behind the arc and shoot a little bit better for all of it to work. But come playoff time, when those guys do turn up and they've got all of that talent, you can see how that could be a dominant offense and a team that plays enough defense. But that's sort of my main skepticism with them, is they just don't pay anybody really to play defense predominantly, except for Dean Wade, $9 million, right? But none of their main guys, that's like their main thing at this point of their career.
Yeah, and I think that it's a point well made. My slight counter to that is that everyone but Maxey has a turn up defensively, which you mentioned, in that they at one point in their careers have all been considered excellent two-way players. And obviously Edgecombe is young, but even last year he flashed a certain amount of just like, oh, he can get after it defensively. So I worry about that more as a regular season problem than a playoff problem. The thing I would say even about like the usage stuff as well is the usage rate of all your top players is always going to sort of exceed that 100% threshold, because these guys don't all play together and they don't all play in every game. If these guys don't play every game, or you stagger them in ways, it's just like there are natural ways for these guys to have usage rates of 28 to 32 and still be effective. The only time that won't be true is when they're all in the same lineup together, right? And I am interested to see what sort of offense looks like with all five of those guys on the floor, even more so than what the defense looks like, because I actually think they are naturally set up to defend almost any type of lineup with their guys. Like Maxey's a speed guy, he can defend smaller dudes. I think Edgecombe and Brown are sort of interchangeable on the wing, and Edgecombe can guard smaller, like physical wings. Brown can scale up. LeBron can take whatever forward Brown doesn't guard. And Embiid is a big dude and sort of scheme dependent in that they're going to be in drop coverage. And so I just think that naturally they're going to be set up a certain way where it's like defense, they can almost be a paint by numbers, go through the motions sort of team. But offensively, I feel like there's more to it than just that.
Let's go to break here. I'm glad you brought this up, because I've been thinking about this also in conjunction with the Lakers about what Philly's offenses will look like. So one dynamic with the Lakers with Luka, LeBron, and Austin that I thought was interesting was the Luka and Austin groups without LeBron were very proficient, like plus 10 net rating and above. And then the LeBron groups without Luka and Austin were also very efficient. But it was the blended groups that had a little bit more trouble together. And when LeBron was playing by himself, those groups were much more post-up, elbow-type touches rather than Bron trying to break guys down off of the dribble on ball screens. But the Luka Austin version is very ball screen heavy, of which LeBron can do every job within that. But fundamentally, I think LeBron at this point is a triple threat player, somebody that can catch the ball at the elbow or in the post, and that's where his best shot creation comes from. Philly is one of those teams where Embiid isn't really a role man. That's not what he does at the five spot, despite being as productive as he is. He is also a triple threat, low post touch type of guy. And you can look that in one way of there being a level of redundancy, but I don't really see it that way. I think their horn sets are going to be a freaking nightmare to cover, and they actually sort of have a framework that's really conducive to what LeBron does well on offense at this point. And you combine that with perhaps the fastest backcourt in the NBA, and one of the better ones too, for sure, between VJ and Maxey. That is one point that I think they're going to have to toe a line between those two things being complementary with each other, or two different styles, the way that we saw with the Lakers. And so I'm curious your thoughts on that, because I do think that Philly is a type of team that LeBron can join, and what he's currently best at, they're sort of used to playing that way already.
Redundancy isn't always a bad thing, and in some cases it can be we can play the same way the entire game and be able to replicate some of these skill sets. We talked about this the other day in terms of Luka and Austin, is like, yeah, they can play together, and that was proven last year, but you're going to run a very similar offense with Austin on the court when he's by himself as you are with Luka. Now, Luka's a better passer and makes more skip passes and yada, yada, yada. He's got more size. Maybe you can run post-up actions for him where you might not run those for Austin. But in terms of the ball screen heavy and how you want to play, I think the Lakers, and you even add Colin Sexton to that, they're going to do that over and over and over again. And it's like teams are going to have to catch up to what they're doing. And LeBron and Embiid being able to operate from similar parts on the floor and play like post-up game, and LeBron being a short role threat in the same way that Embiid can be a short role player, but more for like pick and popping and being at the elbow area. I think your Horns point is spot on. I could imagine them also being like a heavy DHO team with Maxi ripping off of DHOs between him and LeBron. Same with Edgecombe. And a lot of the stuff that they can do on that side of the court can be tailored to what LeBron's strengths are. One of the things I'm interested in seeing, what it's going to look like with all of these guys maybe having the ball a little bit less, right? Because one of the things that happened with Embiid missing so much time last year is I thought all of the guards got way more ball handling actions. And having the ball in your hands 30 feet from the basket and being able to see the entire court and set something up versus zipping off of DHOs or playing that style of basketball or initiating through a horn set and then cutting. Like, I'm not saying they can't play that way, but it's a different style than setting up from 30 feet away and running a pick and roll. And so this is why it wouldn't surprise me if there's a little bit of feeling out process and clunkiness that happens earlier in the season in order to refine what they want to be in April, May, and for their hopes, June.
Absolutely. And that's part of the reason why I agree with your point that there's going to be a level of attrition and injury over the course of the year. But for that team to really hit their ceiling, they're going to need to go through that process during the regular season. Yes, they'll always have a level of shot creation out there between all of those guys that if they're missing a player or two, they'll still be able to at least have functional offense out there. But if they don't go through those reps, then that's going to be just a totally different equation for them. One other aspect of their offense, too, to consider is between LeBron, Brown, and Maxi, you're talking three of the five most productive transition offense players in the NBA. And just from a basketball curiosity standpoint, can you have three of those guys on the same team and all three be productive? Or is that something where they step on their toes, right? Because all three of those guys did it for three separate teams. Can they be three of the top 10 transition guys in the NBA this year? If they can, like, you combine that with what I think they could do in half-court offense, like, that's a great combination.
I'll be interested to see what the hit-ahead actions look like with these guys. And is Maxi throwing ahead? We know LeBron will throw ahead. I'm interested to see how Brown fits into this. LeBron was, I think, second overall in transition points last year. And he remains an elite transition player. Some of that, though, was circumstance of him not always getting back on defense. There's stuff like that, too, right? But his ability to run that middle lane, I actually think, is going to complement Embiid very well, who is a guy who likes to trail a lot. One of the things I thought of when you were talking about the transition stuff is how the 1980s Lakers sort of evolved from being a very half-court-centric team built around Kareem, which is what Philly was for several years as Maxi was coming into his own still with Embiid being sort of the sun that everything revolved around, to being way more of a speed team overall. Now, the Showtime Lakers were Showtime from the very beginning. Magic was a great transition player, but they were still very much a half-court oriented team. And like, no, man, Kareem's going to get his touches. We're going to play this way. And Kareem could run the floor very well, too. But by the time the Lakers got to like 85, 86, 87, it was way more of a Magic Johnson-centric team. And this is how I sort of envision Philly evolving this last like 18 months or so as Maxi has really taken a leap forward. And I think LeBron can fit right into that idea as well. LeBron running the Mack truck lane, Jaylen Brown running the wing, and Maxi like sprinting up court as well. I just think they're going to get a ton of opportunities, Pete. And Edgecombe too, who is a dynamic athlete. If you've got Brown and Edgecombe running the lane with Maxi like sprinting middle and then LeBron rim running or running ahead or even hitting ahead to any of those guys, that's a recipe for like transition dynamite that I think that even if they are sort of built to be a little bit slower as a half court team, when you're talking about running horns actions or DHO stuff or playing through the post a little bit more with LeBron and Embiid, if they can be upwards of like a 20% in terms of play action transition mm-hmm. team, they're going to be dynamic offensively, man, because in the half court, even if the shooting's not all the way there, like enough of those guys are a threat that they will pay off the open looks mm-hmm. and they're going to be able to both bully you and play speedball with Maxey and Edgecombe. And I like Nick Nurse as like a tactical head coach and a guy who sort of is solutions based in this. The thing that I would still caution against is just how quickly it comes together. I can see the pathway and I can see the end game,
right.
But I don't think you can rush it. And I do think they will need reps together.
Yeah, definitely going to need reps. And last point on the transition thing, I could see LeBron scoring a little bit less in those environments, but I think he's going to have a blast throwing outlets to all three of those guys. Let's go to break here. Want to come back, talk about this from a Lakers angle.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE,
and I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today, and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino
and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So, D, before we get into the domino effects and Kuminga and all that stuff, the LeBron era is now over officially with the Lakers. It's an era change here in Lakerland. I'm just curious, now that the dust is settling, how do you feel about all this?
I'd like to kick it back to you. Like, obviously, I've followed the team for a long time, but you worked there during an extensive period of LeBron's time with the team, and I know that while you weren't interacting with him every day, right? Like, you got to see him plenty and understand what his impact was like on the organization and sort of felt his presence and what that means for a team. So I'd love to get your thoughts on this first before I chime in.
Yeah, as I've said many times, I have a ton of respect for LeBron and just how he treats people and just how he moved when no cameras were around. And I will always bring that up first whenever I talk about him. I'm ready for this to move on. Like, I feel like there's a certain level of animosity that has boiled a little bit over the course of this summer between like LeBron fans and Laker fans and both sides being like, I'm glad to be done with you type of thing. I don't really view it that way. I don't have that animosity toward Bron or his fans or anything. I think it was time for both parties, right? That happens sometimes. Like, I just felt like it ran its course. And I think that there's this great urge to, you know, point fingers and be like, oh, you know, if only this had happened or that had happened. Of course, after 8 years, there's going to be some water under the bridge. And I would have loved for LeBron to sign with us to a 2-year, $8 million deal. But I also think that it's way easier to start fresh in that type of place than be like, hey, we've been basketball married for 8 years and max contracts and roster influence and all that, to sort of take a step back to the just dating version that I think is sort of what this is. And that's how I feel right now, is like, I don't view LeBron through any contentious way or anything like that. But I'm also like, I'm excited to root for this Lakers team that's coming up, and I'm excited for the new era.
I'm glad you framed it that way, Pete. I have zero animosity for LeBron. I truly will continue to root for him. I just thought he was such a good player for such a long time, and I will always marvel at the fact that he was supposed to come to the Lakers for his very last act. We were supposed to see the huge decline. We thought it would have come much earlier than 8 seasons. Instead, Pete, he played it 8 full years. He was all NBA for 7 of those seasons. And this last season, his 8th season, he still made the All-Star team. And it wasn't like a pity, like, right, you don't deserve it idea. Like, he was still a very good and excellent player. And I share your, like, oh, man, like, it would have been nice if everyone was in a position where he would have been able to take a step back. But I agree with you. It's very difficult to say, I'm going to stay at the same organization and take a huge pay cut and a big reduction in role, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think you can do one or the other. And to ask him to do both was probably a bridge too far and was wishful thinking on someone like my part, where I was very early in free agency, I was forecasting these great Lakers teams that they could build with $50 million in cap space and LeBron coming back on a minimum potentially. And that feels like, in hindsight, probably naive of me to think that that was even possible, really. Just like you said, it's much easier for him to leave and do that rather than it is for him to stay. I also agree with what you said about it just being time. And I think that the pent-up idea that, like, things were under the surface maybe not as great, that is what it is, honestly. Like, any relationship is going to experience those ups and downs. And honestly, I'm happy that today in his statements that he put up on social media, he's like, you know, thanks again to the Lakers as well, right? And I think that he will look back at this time of his career fondly. And as a Lakers fan, I'll always hold this time, this stretch, as special. I'm not one of those fans that held a bunch of animosity towards LeBron in general or thought lower of him because I rooted for the Lakers or loved Kobe Bryant. And the fact that he came to the Lakers when he did and helped uplift the organization and win a championship, he'll just always hold a special place in my heart for that. That said, it's very difficult to have him be on your team for as long as he was. And then you get a player who usurps him in both power and game and everything else as the new face of the franchise, while keeping everything that he has with him in terms of leadership and cachet and sort of tenure within the group, and act as though everything is going to be the same. And so when you say it was time for both sides to move on, I think that more than anything else, I think everyone felt that. Right. Mm-hmm. And like, I guarantee you, Luka and LeBron are going to embrace the first time that they play Philly or see each other, whatever. But that all these guys are going to then go out there and compete their asses off and try to beat each other and be like, all right, like, let's get after it. These are our new situations. And so I'm excited, just like you are, to see what a Luka-led Lakers team looks like. But we should pivot here, too. Mm-hmm. The end of this with LeBron choosing a team and leaving seals the deal now. And the Lakers do have a hole at the position that LeBron started at. And I'm interested to see where things go. I do expect there to be more moves around the league to happen now because there's a lot of business that has been muted as LeBron has made his decision. And now I do expect some things to start to ratchet up with Cleveland, with Golden State, with Miami, with Denver. I expect the Kuminga situation to get resolved soon, and that there's just a lot of unfinished business around the league. And the Lakers should be playing a part in some of that, at least.
Yeah, that was my main interest in sort of the LeBron watch, was just what would happen after that, because I did think that there would be a domino effect. And let's start with Kuminga, right? The prevailing notion had been that if LeBron chooses Cleveland, that sort of takes them out on any potential offer to Kuminga. But if Bron went anywhere else, that they would be in on Kuminga, and who the Lakers are, you know, still targeting. I am curious what Cleveland could or would do to make that happen, but we were talking about this a little bit earlier. They'd need to dump either Dennis or Strus. There were rumors, for example, about like Dennis to Charlotte for one of the trade exceptions. And then you've still got James Harden kind of hanging out in the balance there, where he turned down, I think, a $42.3 million player option for this year that, in order to sign and trade for Kuminga, that would hard cap them at the first apron. And say they were to send Dennis out, they would have about $40 million under that first apron threshold that you could get Kuminga, say, I don't know, say he starts at $14 million or so. Is James Harden, did he decline a $42 million player option so he could re-sign for $25, $26 million a year? I don't know. And they've got a couple of extra spots available there. So what is your read on that? What is the threat of a team like Cleveland for Kuminga in light of LeBron not choosing them?
Yeah, it's hard to say, Pete, because even the numbers that you cited, they also still don't account for the fact that Cleveland's got multiple open roster spots right now. They trade Dennis away and get nothing back. I think they've only still got 10 or 11 players under contract. And so I think it would only be 10. League minimum for a roster is 13, and most teams carry 14 players, right? So it's not just paying two guys that $40 million. You're actually paying three or four guys that $40 million. And so just start to shave a couple of million dollars off from those numbers. And that's why I think it's tight when it comes to the idea of Cleveland being able to make a real offer for Kuminga, especially when we talk about signing and trading, right? Like, I haven't looked at all their draft assets, and I think they're pretty healthy in that regard. But the prospect of sending out Dennis while taking nothing back is going to take draft capital. And then if you're going to ask Atlanta to participate in a sign and trade, then what are you trading out in order to bring in Kuminga, right? That's another player that you're going to have to trade. Atlanta almost certainly doesn't want that player. I was listening to Bobby Marks talk about this the other day. Atlanta's only $4 million under the luxury tax line right now. So he was saying, look, even if Atlanta does participate in a sign and trade for Kuminga, they're not going to go into the luxury tax to do it. They currently have 16 guaranteed players on their roster already and have a 17th that's on a partial guarantee. So I don't know how this is going to play out. And if the Cavs have to send out draft assets to dump Schroeder and then have to send out draft assets to trade for Jonathan Kuminga and then have to get Harden to agree to a lower number, like I was telling you earlier, yeah, maybe Harden would have taken $26 million if LeBron James was going to
ride
to the team. But is he going to do it for Jonathan Kuminga? And are the Cavs going to see value in saying, okay, well, let's say in order to absorb Jonathan Kuminga at $13, $14, $15 million a season, they have to trade out Dennis and then trade out another rotation player? Like, then are you even better?
Yes, like, exactly. Right? What are you doing here at the end of the day? And that's part of the reason why in the whole lead up to this, I've been wondering, I'm like, is there a degree of calling Kuminga's bluff? Like, I suspect a decent amount of these rumors are coming from his agent. We're about to find out to what degree that's true or not, because a lot of the machinations that you're laying out there, that's the question I end up with, is like, did you make yourself a better team at the end of that?
Yeah, and so, like, these guys want their money. If I'm James Harden, it's my understanding, based off of the reporting way earlier during free agency, that he didn't opt out of this contract to maybe sign a three-year, $75 million contract.
Right.
That it would have been closer to like three $100 million. And if that's the case, then the $10 million that's left over, what's even left over for Jonathan Kuminga at that point, right? So I'm skeptical of this. The math over there is just not mathing. And the rumors about him still being open to returning to Atlanta, that also feels like something his agent would be saying. Like, what are they going to do? Like, send out a bunch of guys to pay Kuminga more money to be a tax team where they've got a billion wings already? Like, I don't know, man. The pathway for him seems very dicey, and I don't know where he's going to end up. And if he's even going to get anything for more than the minimum, unless teams are really going to incentivize the Hawks to participate in a sign and trade.
Yeah, very curious how that wraps up, and I just want it to wrap up, whether it's with the Lakers or not. I'm not trying to do week four, week five of Jonathan Kuminga watch, and that was my main interest of the LeBron decision at this point, frankly, was like, please, God, just let's wrap this up and know what our team is going to be. All right, D, this has been fun. Been great to have you back the last few days. We will be back on Monday, but until then, you've been listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Danger's got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front. Broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
There's Magic got it. Magic fires. It's good. The Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game. Rebound to Lottie. 3 seconds left. Van Exel the winner. It's on the way. Good.
Kobe Bryant. 48 points. 16 rebounds. Shaq with his eighth block. An NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
in Boston. Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe, hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal. Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Pretty pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move.
Two, one,
miss it!
Unbelievable.
for the victory. It's over.
And shot clock now to 5. Bryant.
Yes.
And that was a little tough to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis. 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good. Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers. James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.